Last time I saw you, I don't think you remember me. There was such a crowd of people, but that was at the Canada National Congress here in New
York. Oh, yes.
Yes. Exciting occasion for me to cover that for the entire week and to...
Was that enjoyable the whole week? I didn't go, I must say, I didn't go to all the things. But there were some good discussions in the end, weren't there?
I was there for, I had 12-hour days because I covered...
That must have been exhausting.
Mm. So I didn't participate in a lot of the parties and this sort of thing, but it was a remarkable meeting, and at least in terms of the amount of talent gathered in those two rather small hotels.
Yeah.
And it got off to a rather... Mm. Flimsy start.
Yeah, well, I thought Norman did too much grandstanding there, but...
that's not unusual.
It's not unusual.
But everybody had a good time looking for an issue to come out of it, because the... I guess the title was a little elusive. Well, I can't even remember the title now.
It was called How Does the State Imagine?
Yeah, something like that.
Yes. Yes. Yeah. How Does the State Imagine What, one day?
Yes.
We'll ask, yes.
A rather elusive title that was hard to...
How Does the State Imagine? How does the state...
Well, I want to talk... This interview may sound a little incoherent, but I'll make sense out of it when it finally gets on the air. I'd like to talk to you on two different levels. I want to ask you some questions about the book, and I want to ask you some questions about yourself. Possibly a good way to ask about The Fatal Shore is for you to give me some definitions to some of the terms that you use. Which in a way, I think, tells the story of The Fatal Shore. For example, the term transportation.
Well, transportation meant the... Are we on air, by the way?
Yes.
Oh, I'm sorry. Transportation meant the sending of convicted English criminals against their will to Australia. And it had a specifically criminal meaning. The free emigrated... But the unfree were transported.
These criminals were convicted for crimes that today would seem extremely minor.
Oh, very minor indeed, and particularly at the beginning. I mean, there were people sent out for stealing 5 pounds of cheese or some loaves of bread or tearing up some cucumber plants against the form of the statute. There was a boy sent out on the First Fleet for stealing wig powder. There were watchmakers' apprentices who'd pinch some fusees and arbours and springs. All this, you know, these little details in the great torrent of English criminality at the end of the 18th century. The truth of the matter was, of course, that the English, you know, in this case, it's laws that create criminals. Most of the people who went to Australia, at least in the first 30 years of the transportation period, you know, from 1788 when the First Fleet went there to... Let's say 1820, going there for crimes that we would hardly even call misdemeanors today. And this is because of the overpowering, tremendous, crushing effect of the English criminal statutes. The idea being, at the time, that if you perceived there was a crime wave, the way to deal with the crime wave was to create whole new categories of crime in order to have more people sent in some sort of perverse way.
Didn't you write that there was something like 60... offences that could lead to the death penalty?
Oh, much more than 60. The permutation have never been worked out. There were hundreds. You could be hanged for impersonating an Egyptian. You could be hanged for appearing upon a highway with your face blacked. You could be hanged for breaking down an ornamental shrub on somebody's property. You could be hanged for stealing an heiress. Now, there were all sorts of things that you could go to the gallows for, but the point was that if they had sent everybody to the gallows who could be hanged, then they would have, the English authorities in the 1780s, 1790s, would have been faced with tremendous social unrest. It probably would have precipitated a widespread revolt. So there had to be an alternative, and the alternative was Australia. The great thing about Australia was that once somebody was there, they'd probably never get back. They were neutralized. It was like sending them to Mars, you know, it was dropping them off the edge of outer space.
Back to our definitions, hulks.
Hulks were the English solution to the absence of prisons. You see, the English authorities, and especially the Tories, took a dim view of the idea of keeping somebody in prison because he was being fed at state expense and therefore being rewarded for crime. And the idea of the penitentiary, as it developed in America, was a sort of, you know, improper and radical notion. So what they did instead, since the... such prisons as they had were full to overflowing. was that they used old warships, decommissioned warships, some English, some French, and these leaking hulls without their masts and permanently anchored to the bottom floated there and sometimes indeed sank in hundreds in the main harbours and estuaries of England, and that was where you put your criminals. You just stuck them on board one of these hulks. They were just floating ruins, essentially. And life on them, of course, was very hard. The advantage of the hulk was that most people in the 18th century couldn't swim.
The Fatal Shore, title of your book,
comes from a convict ballad. It was a standard phrase that people used in ballads to denote Australia, not meaning fatal in the sense of lethal, but rather as the place where your fate was to be enacted. I am a native of the land of Erin. I was sadly banished to the Fatal Shore. You know, it's a form of lamentation.
The convict stain.
The belief, the stain was a very deeply held belief of Australians, encouraged, of course, by the English. It resided in the idea that propensities to crime got into your genes. They got into the blood. And so if you were a criminal, your children would be criminals, would be tainted irrevocably by your own crimes. Sins of the fathers would be visited upon the sons down to the nth generation. So Australia, by the time of its first centenary in 1888, was so obsessed with the desire to forget that it had ever been a penal colony that it had elevated the notion of this stain on its history into the sort of main fetish of its national identity. But they solved this by trying very hard to forget about it. The idea was that you either sublimated the stain, you simply forgot about it, rather as if Americans had made a kind of agreement to forget about the Civil War, you know. But of course these things can't be forgotten about, they're too deeply ingrained. Gradually it became apparent even to the most bigoted that that the idea of some genetic propensity for crime is just hokum. And that possibly we might even have something to be, whether the English had something to be proud of in the in having elaborated the transportation system and used it on all those people, whether they had something to be ashamed of there or not. Certainly the Australians had something to be proud of in having transcended it and created their own culture against it.
Well, how has Australian history handled this phase in its life?
Well, first of all, by forgetting about it. That was the big enterprise. The big enterprise was
the textbooks?
When I was a kid, you hardly learnt anything about it. You know, you had this kind of idea that Captain Arthur Phillip got off the boat with his convicts and went charging ashore with their fetters clanking, and they built Bondi Beach, and then in came the sheep and the gold was discovered and we all lived happily ever after. It was passed over. You were never taught anything very much about the convict period, and this remained, I think, pretty much the case until you got a kind of resurgence of interest in real, as distinct from fictional, Australian history in the late 1950s, early 1960s. The thing that broke the dam was the publication of the first volume of Manning Clark's Great History of Australia in 1962. And then, since then, a lot of historians, of course, have worked on it. It's been brought more into... There's an analogy with black history. It's not an analogy one would want to press too hard, but there is an analogy there. 30 years ago, no black in America was taught on an official level that he or she had any history worth bothering about. And now, of course, black studies have proliferated enormously in the last quarter century. A similar kind of thing has happened in Australia with respect to convictry.
Government men.
Government men, a euphemism. If you called a convict in Australia, in early Australia, you know, after 1800, let's say, it was fighting words. If you were a convict and I went up to you and said, how does it feel being a convict, the appropriate response was a bash in the eye. To spare people's sensibilities, you referred to government men, you referred to, in some extreme cases, to empire builders. The descendants of convicts would call their fathers the originals. And so forth. But it was very much, you see, the desire to forget was born almost with convictry itself.
Currency.
Currency, the children of the convicts. In the, you see, convictry differed from slavery in a lot of ways, and one of the most important was, of course, that a slave in America if he or she had children, would find that they were born slaves. Now, this was not the case with convicts. Their children were born free, and being born in Australia as free Australian citizens, they naturally tended to stay in Australia. But they were called currency quite early on, in order to distinguish them from the sterling, who were the free English immigrants. Currency suggested something which was of a purely local value. It was a fairly disparaging term, actually. And what it came out of was the fact that in the early days of settlement, of course, the English authorities, in their wisdom, decided that it was a jail, so you didn't need money in a jail, right? And so, therefore, no bullion supply was sent out, no currency supply was sent out. And so the financial transactions of the colony had to be done in this weird kind of patchwork of imported money, which had been brought in by traders and American whalers and people coming down from India. And so there'd be American dollars and gold mohurs and God knows what. I mean, there was no standard monetary value. And so one of the governors decided to stabilize it by taking the American dollar and punching out the center section of it. And that was worth a shilling, and the ring around it that was left was worth 2 shillings, and that was the currency.
Bush Rangers.
Bush Rangers started off as escaped convicts who took off out of the chain gangs, escaped from the penal settlements, and lived a kind of marauding life on the fringes of settlement. Some of them, not very many, but some were accepted by black tribes lived and hunted with them. But the majority of them led a kind of marginal predatory life. You know, they were chicken stealers, they would hold up the occasional stagecoach. The last of the bushrangers was Ned Kelly, who was killed in 1885. He was our great national hero. There were hundreds of them.
We know the history of the United States and what the European settlers did to the American Indians, but I was surprised when I read The Fatal Shore to see that there was a similar conflict with the Aborigines in Australia. Tell me a little bit about that.
It came out of an understandable, though not a very admirable, reflex of the convicts. See, if you're cast out on the rim of the world, and if you're a piece of criminal trash, the one thing that you want to preserve your self-esteem in the if you've got any, in the midst of the horrendous conditions that they encountered there, was the sense of there being somebody who was lower than yourself, somebody lower down in the human order than you. This was the role that the Aborigines played as far as the convicts were concerned. And so really, I mean, Australian racism, which was incredibly virulent and resulted in the murder of many, you know, the destruction of many tribes and the, of course, the complete disenfranchisement of the Aborigines and the loss of their lands and the loss of their hunting grounds. The racism of Australians really begins with the convicts rather than, strangely enough, than with the officers. And it percolated upwards from there. The original authorities in charge of the settlement obviously weren't concerned to start a tribal war, in addition to the other problems of starting off a colony under these very adverse conditions. But you see, you found when you were there, you know, let's say you're a convict and you go into the encampment beside Sydney Cove and you whip a chicken, and you found whipping the chicken, you'd be hanged for that. But you notice that an Aborigine who went in and stole the next chicken would escape scot-free and no punitive expedition would be mounted after him. And so this produced a tremendous simmering level of resentment, which then became worse and worse, of course, as the settlement pushed out. It always starts amicably, but then as the settlement pushes out and the hunting grounds are taken and the tribal patterns are disturbed and ruined, then the Aborigines fight back. But, of course, their capacity for fighting back, since their technology was that of the Stone Age, was pretty limited. But on the other hand, so was the technology of the convicts, because they didn't have guns either. And so you got this simmering, dirty tribal war that sputtered on and on for 50, 60 years and left its traces ineradicably in the in Australian, particularly in Australian working class attitudes towards Aborigines.
It was the diseases of the white...
Yeah. Pox, the syphilis, smallpox, the first big kill-off of Aborigines occurred accidentally because jail fever, cholera, contact with the prisoners. You know, those ships were, of course, just nurseries of plague infestation. And so sometimes, and they had no antibodies. You know, they weren't used to these novel diseases, pneumonia. Nobody had ever had pneumonia, and so they died. Yeah.
Perhaps the most shocking element of The Fatal Shore is your depiction of the brutality of these prisoners. Brutality was, in that period, a way of life, wasn't it?
Pretty much, because you had a... the systems of punishment were so infinitely more violent than anything much that we have today. But this was not just for prisoners. I mean, this was for the, for Marines too. The way the British Army was run was with the lash, and so therefore there was no impulse to go easy on the prisoners at all. And so, you know, flogging was the basic kind of social transaction of colonial Australia. I mean, and the sentences were carried to terrible lengths. I mean, a Botany Bay dozen, as it was called, was 25 lashes, which probably you or I could stand. Although it would be very, very nasty. But when it got to, let's say, 150 and your backbone was open to the air, or when it got to 500 and your collarbones were showing, then, you know, there was a reasonable chance that you might not survive it. And, I mean, a lot of people did, in fact, die under the lash. But on the mainland, the sentences tended to be smaller than in the outer penal settlements, because there... the lash was just used as an instrument of all-out terror and torture, and it was practically without constraint, and you would have sentences of 1,000 lashes, at the end of which, of course, you would die.
How did it happen that Australia was finally not used anymore as a penal colony?
Because of the Australians themselves, because it became apparent that after 50 years of English colonization, there was a large, or relatively large, population of people who'd been born in Australia, brought up in Australia, some of them of convict parentage, most of them, and others not, who weren't going to put up with being used as a dump anymore. And also, of course, the thing that killed it off, I think, probably more than anything else, was the discovery of gold in 1850, because you couldn't have the country being two things. You couldn't have it having the reputation of being a kind of ultimate deterrent, as being a hell on earth, a place where nobody would want to go to, on one hand, and on the other hand, being El Dorado. It had to be either one or the other. And the British voted with their feet, as it were, and they chose it as El Dorado, and suddenly there was this explosion of free immigrants coming in. And and they didn't want to be living in a place that had a reputation as stained, as a jail, as a concentration camp. And so gradually it wound down, but the basic reason why it wound down was that it simply did not deter English crime.
What's been the reaction in Australia to this particularly vivid account of Australia's history?
It hasn't been published there yet. They're certainly curious about it. They're very curious about it, as a matter of fact. I think there'll be some dissension about it, because there are some things in the book that go against certain received ideas about Australian history. But, you see, Australians are very curious. They've become very curious about this part of their history. They're not... concerned to forget it anymore, like they were, 50 years ago. It was a taboo subject once, but it very much no longer is. So I think they will be interested. The English have been very, they've received it very well.
But where did you grow up in Australia?
Sydney.
What was it like growing up in Australia? I was the reason I asked.
Delightful. It was like California without the defects.
I was talking to Rick Smolin, who was the producer of the photography book called A Day in the Life of America, who did a similar book.
On Australia. I remember it, yeah.
Ago, and he said one of the reasons he liked Australia was so much, it was his perception of what America might have been 40 or 50 years ago.
Yes, except that Americans keep saying that Australia reminds them of America. Why is it then that America doesn't remind me of Australia? See, you've got this kind of, I don't mean you personally, but Americans generically seem to have this kind of notion of Australia as being a sort of rebirth of the frontier, which you so long ago lost. As though it in some way were Texas circa 1886.
And it's not?
It really is not. It's the most, this sort of Crocodile Dundee notion of Australians being this bunch of 6'4" guys with corks on their hats staring at the mighty horizon, and cutting cane with one hand and strangling large reptiles with the other, is hokum.
Oh, shucks.
It's not a frontier society.
Well, there'd be one place left in the world.
It is the most highly urbanized English-speaking society in the world. Most Australians live in cities. 80% of us live in cities. Most Australians, as I keep on saying, have never seen a goddamn kangaroo outside of a zoo. And if you put them down in the bush, they wouldn't know what the hell to do with themselves. They wouldn't know. They no pay telephone, my God. You know, we certainly have a kind of... we're perhaps a little closer to the bush than most Americans are to the West. We tend to sentimentalize our cultural memories of the bush and of the pioneer days in very much the same way that you sentimentalize your acquired memories of the frontier. It is not a frontier society. There are some very tough people in it, and there's a lot of, you know, tremendous go-getters, and there's an awful lot of empty space. But, and we always praise the outer spaces, but when we're asked to go themselves, we generally prefer not to.
What was your boyhood like in Sydney?
Oh, well, it was divided between Sydney and the outback. I had a relatives of mine had a sheep farm, ranch, you'd call it, station. And so I'd spend a certain amount of summer holidays stringing wire and, killing rabbits and doing other useful, feeding the chooks and doing other useful chores. But most of the time in Sydney, and Sydney at the time and still now is it's a wonderful city. It's big, expansive, raffish, open air kind of place. You know, people knock off and they go down to the beach for lunch and there was a genuine sense of, you know, really democratic access to the harbour, for instance. You know, on a Saturday afternoon, you'd see millions of boats, you know, some of them like matchboxes with little sails on, homemade ones, bigger ones, you know, all enjoying themselves. You'd fish, you'd play tennis, all that sort of stuff. It was a very, very good place to grow up in.
Were you able to trace your ancestry back to...
No, I don't know. I don't have a real horse thief sitting in the family tree. I'm sorry. The primal hues came staggering out of a bog in Roscommon in the west of Ireland in 1839. His name was John Hughes. He went out to Australia. He was a cop. And he then bought some land, and then he bought some more land, and then unfortunately his descendants gave it away to the Catholic Church, a great pity. But we've always been... I mean, basically, the family was lawyers, at least for the last three generations.
So your father was a lawyer?
My father was a lawyer. My brother was a lawyer, is a lawyer. My other brother is a lawyer.
Literary-oriented?
Sure, they liked reading. I was very lucky. There was a big Victorian library that we sort of inherited from grandfather. See, the great luck of my life was that television did not come to Australia until 1957. And so, therefore, one amused oneself by reading, playing chess and fishing rather than by sitting in front of the box.
It didn't come to the Swaim family until 1962.
Well, there you are, you see. A tremendous benefit.
How did you develop this love or perhaps even a passion for art?
Certainly not from any family background. Because, I mean, we did have some pictures, but they were mainly sort of, portraits of the usual sort, you know. I mean, nothing that you would call a remarkable work of art anywhere in the house. There was a quite good museum in Sydney, though, and I blundered into it by accident one day. I was never taken to it. I think it's a great pity to take children to museums too early. It should be a bit of an adventure. It should be a bit of a surprise. It should be something you do of your own volition, possibly even something secretive and forbidden. I used to go into the Art Gallery of New South Wales and look at the nudes. There weren't very many, but there were some.
Secret and forbidden.
Yes, that's right. And so I guess I kind of got interested in that, and but more complicated than that, because I suppose what got me interested in art really was seeing postcard reproductions of surrealist paintings when I was at a Jesuit boarding school, and these filled me with a sort of intimations of mystery and revolt, as they still to some extent do, and I thought, God, that can't be art. Can it be art? Well, maybe it is, you know, and so I followed that up. You know, you sort of gradually, your eye gets hooked by an image and then you pursue it, or it reels you in.
Did you study art in college?
No. There was no way of doing it. There was no art history course available at university in Sydney, and there was only one university in Sydney then. That, we're talking about the 50s. What I did instead was I was intended to be a lawyer, and I... there was a combination course, arts law, not visual arts, sort of liberal arts, you know, history, classics. And to everybody's stupefaction and disappointment, including my own, I succeeded in failing first year arts, which is something that a moderately intelligent bandicoot could have passed. Mainly because, you see, after so long in a Jesuit boarding school, I, with people supervising your work, as soon as I was put in a university, or as soon as I went into a university with nobody to make you work, I didn't work, you know, and so I spent all my time on university journalism. And so then, you know, great conniptions, and clearly I wasn't going to make a lawyer, you know, and by that time I knew I wanted to go away to Paris, wear a beret, smoke Gauloises, and study art. This was unthinkable. Therefore, a kind of compromise was achieved, and I studied architecture in Sydney instead, and I stuck with that for 4 years. Never finished the course, because somebody came along and offered me a book to write, which I then, I'd been freelancing and so forth for, by that time, for the downtown, you know, for the real press rather than the university press. So anyway, in, I guess I left the university in 63 and went to Europe.
What brought you from the fatal shore in Europe to this distant shore?
Ah, Time Life. They hired me out of London. They were looking for an art critic, and somebody there read a book that I'd written on the imagery of heaven and hell in Western art, which sank without a trace, sold no copies, but thank God totally transformed my life. This guy picked it up and read it, and they were, luckily for me, looking for an art critic at the time. And evidence of the desperation of their search was that they were casting their net so wide. And somebody asked me, would I come over and try out, you know, and so I did, this being in 1970, and, you know, I've been there ever since.
How does one try out as an art critic?
You write things, don't you? You know, you sort of, you come over and you look at exhibitions and you write reviews of them. And then,
kind of on spec?
On spec, yes.
On spec?
Yes, well, they keep you in a hotel while you're doing it and pay you a stipend, and then a month or so later they say, right, do you want a job? That was how it worked in my case, anyway.
Did you have any kind of cultural shock adjusting from Australia and Europe to New York?
I had more adjusting from Europe to New York, I think, than I did in adjusting from Australia to Europe, because you seem, you know, sort of, in a sense, growing up in Australia, one's fundamental culture, you know, sort of high culture dreams were, of course, European, you know, rather than American. Your low culture dreams were American. But your high culture ones had to do with enacting the Cyril Connolly-like life on the Mediterranean, you know, looking at Quattrocento altarpieces in churches and reading Proust. All that stuff. The big surprise for me was coming to America, because I guess I really didn't know what to expect, and I wasn't prepared for the enormous kind of impaction and then vivacity of the New York art scene, or the terrifying amount of information that about art that gets pumped through this culture at any given time, the number of exhibitions you have to look at and in some notional way deal with, even if you don't write about them. See, the English art world was very small. It was very, very small in comparison to the American. There were some very good things in it, but it definitely was institutionally and in every other possible way a lot smaller. There are no institutions in England or France comparable, say, to the Museum of Modern Art. You know, the amount of stuff that you have to tackle just to do with the contemporary is much, or was much less there than it was even here in 1970. And of course, it's accelerated immensely since then.
I know very little about art, but my understanding
that makes two of us.
No, well, that's not true. But I understand that at least some people have alleged this to be the case, and I'm not sure it is. Perhaps you can shed some light on it, that New York has developed into the world's capital.
Well, that's what they say, and in a certain sense it has. I mean, it is the world's capital in the sense that it is definitely the sort of main compressor of information. It's the principal switchboard, and it's the place where most of the money is exchanged. But you see, I'm very much against this because coming from Australia, I guess, predisposed me to be against it. I'm very much against the idea of this model of there being an imperial centre surrounded by a whole lot of provinces. I think that's not true. It certainly was true of Paris, let's say, in 1870, you know, where you had that sense that Paris was sucking, I wasn't around then, but, you know, well, reading about it, one gets the sense that, that sort of slight resentment caused and excess satisfaction caused by this image of Paris like some immense thing sucking everything out of the provinces. Everything that is any good will be seen in Paris. Everything that is of any quality must be certified in Paris. Something of the same certainly occurs in New York. But the thing is that the I think we, in truth, we have a much more decentralized culture now than we did 20 years ago, partly because of the increased network, you know, museum network around the world, and you know, particularly inside America, and also because conditions of living in Manhattan have become so extremely difficult for so many artists that it is no longer true that you can necessarily, you know, that a really good artist can necessarily afford or even wish to live in Manhattan. And so the you have to take that into consideration. You know, I think the model of the Imperial Center is beginning to come apart, which is not to say that New York isn't of colossal importance and probably the most important single city.
There are just hundreds and hundreds of art galleries.
Too many.
I pass them all the time.
Too many. It's ridiculous.
Never anybody inside. Yeah. I just wonder how they...
They have people inside them. But the trouble is we've got this crazy art glut, you know. And there was a point, I don't know whether it's still true or not, it probably isn't because the art schools have been falling on hard times lately, but there was a point a few years ago when the best statistics I could get on this was that the art schools of America every year were turning out 35,000 graduates, you know, painters, potters, sculptors, blah, blah, blah. Now, that means that the art schools every 2 years turned out as many people, as many artists as there had been people in Florence in the last quarter of the 15th century at the height of the Renaissance. A truly preposterous situation. Assuming that each of these people paints, let's say, conservatively 20 pictures a year, you know, you've got all these millions of pictures ticking up like an unpayable taxi bill. Where do they all go? Where's the elephant's graveyard? I mean, there must be some place out in New Jersey. I don't know. And not much social use is assigned to the, you know, to the work of this immense unemployable artistic proletariat. There's a kind of worship of creativity as though it were therapeutic, which is widely disseminated in America. But you see, if you have an art glut, it leads to all sorts of very weird competition. It leads to and the sort of structures of reputation which look more like Hollywood, which look more like Hollywood than the traditional art world, because it becomes so very competitive. It becomes kind of ridiculous in a way. All of this, I think, bodes badly for the American art world, but it's pretty much irreversible.
Well, I have a friend with whom I went to college who's a modern artist. His name is Bill Richards.
It's hard to avoid being a modern artist these days, don't you find?
He was telling me that perhaps his biggest income came from not any of his paintings, but from a television commercial he did for Travelers Insurance, which ran during the Super Bowl and showed him painting on a gigantic canvas.
Oh, is that the guy? I remember that commercial. Yes, yeah. It was a sort of big canvas that looked vaguely like a Frank Stella. Yes,
He has a studio in Soho.
Oh, really?
He's been working as a full-time artist for about 10 years.
But you see, not everybody gets to make commercials either.
No, it was a fluke that he was able to do that.
Yes, a lucky fluke.
Yes, and as a result, he is now a member of the Screen Actors Guild. Well, I guess that your Australian roots never left you, and in fact, to a degree, from what I understand, the book The Fatal Shore came as kind of an offshoot from another book, which was about art, an art book of yours, isn't that?
It was sort of an offshoot from a television series that I was doing in Australia back in the early 70s, only in the sense that we were shooting down there, and many years ago I'd written this juvenile history of Australian art. I mean, it wasn't called A Juvenile History of Australian Art, but that I look back on it with some embarrassment. Then a few years later, this idea came up, well, what about doing some television programs based on this? So I said, okay, I went down there. And anyway, the long and the short of it was that we found ourselves filming the section about the early colonial period, and we were in Port Arthur, which is one of the big secondary penal colonies down in the south of Tasmania. The the closest thing that we have to a nostalgic national ruin. It's sort of, for us, it's a sort of combination of Paestum and Dachau all rolled into one. And so there among these old crumbled stones and the ruins of the cells and so forth, I was trying to figure out some way of talking about why you don't actually have much good art in a jail. All our artists naturally were forgers, transported, or most of them were. Ditto with our writers. You had to do something to get to Australia. You didn't get there on the basis of your creative merit. While ruminating about this, I thought, well, you know, somewhere there must be a book that tells me, that will give me some picture of the human side of all this. We know about in general terms, about the administrative side of it, how the thing was administered, how it worked, you know, what the British government intended to do. But how did the convicts feel about it? What were their experiences? What sense, if any, did they make of this bizarre enterprise of social excretion? And so therefore, I started looking around for such a book and found to my stupefaction that there actually wasn't one. There were at least two very good academic histories, and there were a lot of papers that had been written on this or that aspect of convictry. But there wasn't really a book which, did, as I suggested, so try and sum up the human meaning of this enterprise and do it from primary sources. So I thought, well, perhaps there is a story here. Indeed, there is. And so then talked to a publisher about it, not the one who published this book in the end, and then started work. I must say that if I'd known then what I know now, I doubt that I would have started it, because I didn't think there was that much. I thought I could finish it in 3 years.
Well, it's a hell of a book, Robert Hughes. I can assure anybody who listens to my broadcast that once they start reading it, they will not put it down, because I read it. I'm known as a fast reader. I usually read a book a day, but it took me 3 days to read The Fatal Shore, simply because I wanted to absorb as much of it as I can, and that's important, because you can flash through books a lot if you have to, but Fatal Shore, I was so fascinated and appalled as I read the history of these convicts and their brutal treatment that I slowed down to take it all in. It's a wonderful book, and it was a lesson to me, because I had no idea. I don't think any of us knew, but with The Fatal Shore, we're going to find out. Robert Hughes, thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
Hang on one second.